Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we will go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, and one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight we will explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. In conjunction with Slick Enterprises, we're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Slick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 140-plus years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at www.gridirongreatsmagazine.com. We're sponsored by MSB Sports Cards. Check out their website for one of the largest selections of football cards and vintage football memorabilia. Their store is available at www.msbsportscards.com. And we're also sponsored by BST Auctions. Check out their upcoming auction information on their website at www.bstauctions.com. It is at this time I am honored to introduce my guest co-host, who's filling in for Joe Squires this evening. He is a longtime contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine. He is a San Francisco 49ers football historian and San Francisco 49ers football memorabilia historian. He hails from the West Coast, San Francisco, California. I'd like to introduce to our listeners tonight my good friend, Mr. Martin Jacobs. Martin, welcome to the show this evening.
How are you, Bob?
I'm very good. How's the weather out there? Because I got snow, sleet, freezing rain.
Well, we had two weeks of heavy rain, lots of flooding. And yesterday and today, the last 2 days have been just beautiful sunshine weather, about 65 degrees.
Wow.
I cherish that.
Martin, I'm glad you were able to help us out this evening for the show. And I want to talk a little bit about a couple of things. And in particular, we would like to spend some time on your recent book, which was entitled San Francisco 49ers Legends, The Golden Age of Pro Football. And again, I read your books, and this was just another one of your books where I started reading it at night, and Brenda started yelling down to me, "Are you coming to bed?" And I said, "I only got a few more pages left. I want to finish it." And to me, it was the type of book that I couldn't put down. I read it from cover to cover in one night. And my first question for you is, why did you decide to write this book?
Well, it's a labor of love, and to me, I'm 74 years old now, and I felt I wanted to do something to give back to to all the fans and let them know what it was like growing up in the 50s and 60s and how the game has changed and with the rule changes and from everything, being at the stadium and the way it was at Old Kezar Stadium. And I did it for that reason only, just like to put down my, you could call it my obituary. But it was a labor of love, and I best described it as if I was still back in those days watching the game. And I'm glad you enjoyed the book, because it's...
I got to say this, when I was reading it, I just really was captured by the way you wrote it, because you did feel like you went back in time, to say the least. And I can envision myself, and I know I've told this story numerous times, that I remember the first time I ever went into the Yale Bowl with my father. It was 1966. It was a warm fall day. My father and I were rope guards, and those were the days where Yale used to get 70,000 people for a game on a Saturday. And I still remember my father with his top hat, his short-sleeved white shirt and tie, and I was clutching his hand because I had never seen so many people in my life all at once. And I was just hoping I wasn't going to lose him, because I said to myself, I have no idea how I'm going to get home or whatever. And my father was very strict with me. He said, you don't let my hand go until we get into the seats. And I do remember, and during the game, a couple of the students were trying to cross the rope to get into the – the rope basically separated the box seats, if you want to call them that, because it was a bowl. There was all just benches everywhere. And the ropes basically prevented people from the general admission seats to go to the reserve seats there. And I remember a few times he yelled at a few of the students. He said, get back. You not cross that. Get back to your seats. And they turned around and then they moved. That was for sure. But
yeah.
Again, we're talking about your book here. And I, that one part of your book where you were talking about going to the game with your father there really brought back that memory for me.
Well, the thing of it is, when you put it down on paper, it's there forever. It's the history. And if you were to ask me to do this book 10 years from now, I don't know if my memory will be suited to remember back then. But seeming I could still recall everything. I tried to cover everything from a fan's point of view, to the vendors, to the band, to the majorettes, to the anybody who had to do with the 49ers, you know. And I tried to paint the picture. It's just like painting a picture. And I try to be as articulate as I could.
Yeah, you did a fantastic job on it. I mean, again, you felt like when you were reading that book that you were just back in time. And again,
the problem I'm having now is finding people to share this with. All the fans today, they're only interested in what's happening today. They're not into the history. Everything is in the future,
right.
And it's such a valued thing to remember, but I try to think, well, maybe they just don't care. I mean, you have to have lived it, and I lived it out there. I mean, I was the first one in the stadium. I'd be there at 9 a.m. in the morning. I'd be the last one to leave, maybe 4:30 or 5, and I just couldn't get enough of the experience, because Kezar Stadium was just to the greatest stadium at the time.
Well, you know, I think it goes along with the education of the fan. If we can educate people about the history of the game, which is what Gridiron Greats magazine has been trying to do for years now, I think become interested. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank God you're doing it, because you're the only one covering the past, and it just it's just great. I mean, I love it because I'm a collector, and I love looking back. And just hearing stories from people, because I can go to the game now and I don't get the experience that I had back then. You're not close to the players, you know.
I agree with that 100%. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and the fans today, you want to discuss statistics? They don't care about statistics. They just want to know we win, we lose. I'm out there to have a good time, a social. It's not like like living it or playing the game for the love of the game and the dedication and the loyalty. It's not there anymore. And because of that, I'm a little bit discouraged from what I read and hear, and I read the paper every day, and it's just the same old thing. You know, they just don't pay attention to the past, and that's why I do these books.
Well, I truly appreciate the book. What I was going to say is, when my wife Brenda and I go to Yale games now. To me, it's tough because you're in a stadium that holds 70,000 plus. You're lucky you get 5,000-10,000 people, and people are more disinterested in the game than anything else. I mean, it's just a social event for them, like you're saying, and they really don't see what's going on the field. They're not seeing any plays develop, or they're lost. And again,
they're lost.
To the
and
60s.
Yeah, it's
go back
just
to the 60s
it's
and,
a, yeah. Different feeling. It's a different feeling, and I have five children and four boys, and they're just not interested in the past, and it just it's a little discouraging because it was such a great, wonderful time, and to collect
right.
a chin strap or get an autograph on the field now is no such thing. You have to pay
right.
big money for an autograph, and it just discourages me because I just think that's not the way it was meant to be, but that's the way it is.
Oh, I agree. Did you have a favorite chapter that you wrote?
Yeah, I sure did. And it's called The Fighting Spirit. And it was a player named Joe Arenas. Now, Joe, the reason this is my favorite chapter and my favorite interview of a 49er is because Joe Arenas was a World War II veteran at Iwo Jima. And he hit the beach and he got shot through the back.
Mm-hmm.
He was supposed to be paralyzed, never walk again. He recuperated 3 to 4 years recuperation, 7 months in the Navy hospital. He came back, got drafted by the 49ers in the 8th round. He wasn't really considered to make the team, but he was good in college because he played a year in college, and he ended up being a great 49er, returning punts, kickoffs, and as a running back. In fact, he still holds the record I think with a 34.6 return on kickoff return for a 49er
right.
all-time record. So that's my favorite chapter because of the story and the comeback that he made from being shot in the back to at
mm-hmm.
World War II to be a great 49er. That's a great story.
Well, I think the whole flavor of football, especially when you had the AAFC right after World War II, you had all the players coming home from the war. America was starved for entertainment. Football was still a man's game. And these are guys who were veteran tough who basically saw their lives pass in front of them, you know, between Europe and between the Pacific. They're happy to be home, and now they're getting paid to play a kid's game the way they feel about it. And they played with a spirit. They played with a love of the game. They played for victory. It was just such a different time, and to me, it's just so lost today in the game. It's just amazing, and it's funny you brought up kick returns. It's so difficult to watch an NFL game today when there's either a punt or, more importantly, at the kickoff after a touchdown or the beginning or second half of the game, because how many times it doesn't get returned because it's 20 yards deep. I mean, you might as well kick it into the stands for crying out loud. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's still just to watch the point after touchdown being kicked so far away. I mean, it just kind of changes the game to me. It just I just don't like it. But what are you going to do, Bob? We have to deal with it.
No.
I mean, that's the way it is now. But I have no doubt that the players back from those days could compete with the players today. Because Bob St. Clair was a personal friend of mine, and he said it was all about technique. He said you could have a 200-pound, 240 lineman against a 300-pounder, and he can outmaneuver him. It's all the technique, and he was sold on that. He thought for sure that the all-pros from then could compete with the all-pros of today. And I agree.
Oh, I agree with that. I mean, they didn't get to work out,
Bob, 8 hours a day in weight rooms and all that. They like Hugh McElhaney, he worked out 4 hours in the morning and he sold potato chips in the afternoon. I mean, that was the lifestyle of pros back then. Just imagine if they put 12 months a year into training like they can now. It'd be a whole different. Those players would be just as good.
Right.
I agree
100% with them. I agree with that. I got another question I got to ask you. Do you have a favorite book that you've read over the years on the 49ers? I'm just curious about that, and I'm sure our listeners would be curious about that. I mean, you are all, to me, you are Mr. 49er.
I have a number of the books, Bob, but there's one called Founding 49ers. Founding 49ers by David Newhouse. It's called The Dark Days Before the Dynasty. That's a good book also, but that deals again with the past, with the older, but of course that's what I like reading about. And there's another book called The Million Dollar Backfield, and that's by Dave Newhouse also. So that that's in fact, you know, I just learned not recently that the million, when I did this last book, that the 49ers million-dollar backfield wasn't the first million-dollar backfield. The first million-dollar backfield was the Cardinals, Chicago Cardinals of 1947. I forgot the players' names, but they were the first million-dollar backfield, so didn't originate with the Niners.
Now, that's very interesting for the simple reason that the Cardinals really never did anything over the years, especially when they were in Chicago, and did even less until they actually got into Arizona, you know. And that is interesting. Although back then, having a small league, there were tough teams, and all the teams were pretty fairly, you know, talent was pretty fairly distributed throughout the teams.
Well, I know the owner was Charles Bidwell, and I do know that the running backs were, now that I remember, was Paul Chrisman, Charlie Trippi, Paul Harder, and Marshall Goldberg. But like you said, it wasn't the first million-dollar backfield. They were the dream backfield until the 49ers, McElhinney, Perry Tittle, and John Henry Johnson became the million-dollar backfield in 1954.
I want to squeeze in one more question before we have our guests coming up. There's one area that I, from time to time, I get questions asked of me. How difficult is it to put together and or find AAFC game programs from 46 to 49 as a collector?
Let's put it like this. You have to have patience. The best place to find them is on eBay, but you have to be patient. I'd say about every 3 or 4 months, you'll find one from 46, 47, but they do come up frequently, but not the real popular games. Like championship programs are harder to find, of course, than the preseason or regular season. So you just have to be patient, and then you have to bid on it and hope that you can outbid your competitor, because there's other people out there that also collect the media guides and the football programs, the All-American Football Conference.
And to me, you're reading history of the AAFC, and because it was such a short history, and there's so, you know, to me, so few programs, so few press guides out there. And,
in fact, I'm missing a program with the 49ers versus a semi-pro football team called the San Jose Packers, played in San Jose in 1952, and only 600 people attended the game. So it's just a program that I've been looking for the last 35 years, and it just hasn't come up.
Wow.
But they did have a program there. The 49ers organization actually has a copy of the program, but I've been trying to purchase one to complete my run of programs.
Wow.
Yeah.
So if any listeners have it, please contact us. We'll set you up with Martin, and I'm sure you can negotiate a deal on that one.
Sure.
Okay. Now we're gonna move right along in our show tonight, and I'd like to introduce our guest. Our guest tonight is an expert and collector of vintage footballs and early equipment of the game. He was featured as our super collector in our winter 2014 issue. And he's recently written an article, I believe it was in issue 54, on the oldest football in existence. I would like to welcome tonight Mr. Robert Tibby. Bob, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Bob. It's great to be here.
Thank you for coming on. Bob, I'm going to start off by asking you to, and I know we spoke, I believe it was at the Cleveland National a couple of years back, and I want to... if you could give our listeners some background on how you became interested in collecting vintage football equipment and vintage footballs.
Oh, boy, sometimes I wonder that myself. When I look around and see everything I have. But, you know, As a kid, I grew up in Pittsburgh, and I followed the Steelers. You know, I think Bobby Lane was the big feature player then, and the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Hornets, which was the hockey team then. But, you know, everything changes. So instead of the Hornets, now they have the Pittsburgh Penguins. And on the good side of the change, the Steelers now win more than they lose, and I live on the other side of the country. But, you know, that's really what got me interested is change. You know, change is what got me interested because that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in how football has changed since it started in the 1800s up to today.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the first football helmet I played with when I was a kid. It was an old leather football helmet, had a little padding in it, no face protection. It was just something that was passed on from my dad. Now you look at the game and the technologies involved, the carbon fiber and Kevlar helmets with full face shields, their impact-absorbing helmets, custom-fitted to fit on a player's head. In many cases, they're fitted with a radio transmitter and impact sensors. You know, so it's that change that intrigued me. So, you know, as an adult, when I started collecting, that was what interested me, was the evolution of football and other sports. I don't just collect football. But it just led me to search for older and older equipment and artifacts. And
well, Robert,
so today,
this is Martin. Can you tell us about your vintage helmet collection?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as I said, you know, I would say that probably the theme of my collection of helmets is to show the different types of headgear from the earliest days of football all the way up through the introduction of, you know, the modern-style helmet. I guess, you know, if I were looking at my helmet, my collection, and I wouldn't say helmets because I have headgear as well, it starts, the earliest piece I have is an 1860s football stocking cap, you know, which is what they wore initially just to protect their ears. And then chronologically, I have a variety of strap head harnesses. Again, those simple strap helmets that in many cases were made by shoemakers just to protect the ears. I have 4-strap and 8-straps, all from about the 1890s. And then I think as we moved into the 1900s, you know, then they suddenly became a little more concerned about protecting their head and their forehead. So there was a real variety of helmets then. I have flat top helmets, both leather and canvas. Those were popular 1900 to the 1920s. Aviator helmets, rain cap style helmets, popular from 1900 to about 1920. The dog ear styles, which came out pretty much in the mid-teens, and they were popular into the 30s. Then the Grange-style helmets up into the 30s and right up to when they Riddle first started making the first plastic helmets. So, and then I have a variety of, I guess, what I would call unique styles, including an executioner helmet, several of the executioner face masks, 4-tab and 8-tab Princeton helmets from the 20s. I even have a reach adjustable helmet that was made, a reach made in 1903 to 1906, and supposedly they would adjust any type of head. So that's, pretty much a full range.
Bob, I got to ask you a question, though, while we're talking about helmets, and try to refresh my memory because I was trying to think about it today. When we were at the National, I thought you had picked up some quasi-rare headgear from the 20s. Was that true, or was it something else? I forgot now. I don't know.
Well, actually, when I first met you at the National, yeah, I was buying a helmet from the booth right next to you. It was a helmet from the 1930s, but it was very unique as it had a full cage face mask on it.
That's right. I remember that now. Okay. Yep. Yeah. Describe that.
Well, it's definitely a pro style football helmet. It's made by Reach. But what intrigued me most was the face mask, because prior to that, you didn't have I mean, in the 20s, they had the executioner helmets, which had a face piece on it. But when you started getting into the metal face masks, you know, those weren't very popular until probably in the 30s, the late 30s and the 40s. So that full face mask, it's one of the only ones I've seen of that style. I think at that same show, I also picked up an early 40s helmet that had what they called the cowcatcher face mask on it.
Okay. All right. I can only imagine how that steel frame could do injury to a player by, you know, tackling or whatever and getting caught in that. And again, just think about it. How many guys played with nothing? And then all of a sudden you see this, and it's like, wow. I can only imagine what they were talking about on the field after seeing that. You know what I mean? So.
Oh, yeah, Paul. You know, I look at some of this equipment that I have, and some of it's so primitive that not only would I think it do damage to another player, but I think some of it would be damaging to the player wearing it.
Right.
Now, in the period, you know, they started, I talked about the stocking cap that they wore in the 1860s and up into the 1870s to protect their ears. But they also had the nose guards, the old Morel nose guards, the single piece of hard plastic, covered your nose, you bit on a mouthpiece to hold it up against your face. I have several of those, but you know, I look at those, and actually I've tried them on, and you just think, wow, that would probably do more damage to your face than it would protect you.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, I do know, Bob, that in 1954, the 49ers, up to that time, had more face masks. That Joe Perry, a fullback, he wore a Lucite face mask, and it almost covered his whole face. It had a cutout for his mouth where he could breathe through, but it was a plastic mask, but they did away with that, I think, after a year or two. Are you familiar with that?
I have a couple of those, and it's just a plain piece of, and I'm not sure what it's made out of, a hard plastic or something, but it is transparent. Right, and there's just a little oval cut in the front for your face, for your mouth, so you could breathe. Those were around probably for, as you said, you're exactly right, a couple years.
They're supposed to shatter. They said they shattered, and the players complained about it. And then they went to, I guess, the steel bar mask that coated with the rubber, the single bar mask. I think Cleveland Brown started wearing that, and then they had a radio in their helmet. Do you have a helmet with the radio that they supposedly put in the NFL? I think it was about 1956, I think.
I don't have any helmets or the radio in it. What I focus on in my collection is I try to focus on the late 1800s the way up until, you know, about 1950 when we got into what I consider the modern gear.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I sort of focus on, I want to get back to the very beginning, to the birth of the sport, and sort of follow it up into the modern period.
I'm just curious, Robert, where would you find these helmets? I know at the national convention they might pop up, but where would you find a helmet from the early 1900s or something like that?
Well, I've been collecting probably for 40, 50 years. So, you know, initially it was garage sales, yard sales, people cleaning out their barns, you know, and then and then, as you mentioned earlier, with some of the stuff that you collect, you know, with when eBay came along, suddenly there was a lot of stuff available. That
do you see a lot of fakes out there in the industry, people passing on a helmet from, say, 1900 that really isn't?
It's hard. I think it's hard to do that with a helmet. Now, there are companies out there that do make helmets that are, you know, throwback helmets and so forth. But I think most collectors can see those, and you always see the keyword somewhat on eBay when it says you know, like flat top style helmet, you know, when they put that extra word in there.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, there are, and I do collect, you know, I collect baseball, basketball, all kind of things, and some of the sports, yeah, there are a lot of, you really got to do your homework. There's no doubt about that.
Definitely.
I'm sure you gotta have an encyclopedic knowledge, especially when you see something at a barn sale or a tag sale or whatever, and you know, obviously you're going to take a chance on it. And again, if the person selling it knew what they actually had was the real artifact of the game, you wouldn't be finding it at a tag sale. You know what I mean? So,
yeah,
again,
that is
definitely something that, you know, you can find things like that at that time. Now, last issue, you wrote an article on what is considered to be the oldest football you own. Can you shed some light on that to our listeners and individuals who did not see that article yet?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. The oldest football that I own is, in fact, the oldest known football, with an inflatable bladder that's, you know, tucked inside a rubber cover with a slit in there so you can lace it and, you know, inflate it or reinflate it and then relace it. The ball itself, this is actually the ball is the prototype for the very first modern football. So it was patented in December of 1867 by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. In fact, the ball has on it all the original tags that were attached to it by the Patent Office 150 years ago. So I think there's two. You walk over here, I can see the ball. Yeah, there's two tags on it. You know, one it shows the patent number and who submitted it and the dates, and then there's another tag on there showing when it was patented and stuff. And they're actually on there with a little piece of wire, and they were put on there by the Patent Office, and they're still on there. So, you know, those really established the exact date and age of the ball. And, you know, 1867, that's what, 2 years before the first known college football game.
Right, right.
And I actually contacted the Patent Office, and I have a certified copy of the patent that goes with the ball. It was issued to Henry A. Alden, who was an employee and with the New York Rubber Company, and he was the one who submitted the patent on behalf of the New York Rubber Company. So the ball was patented December 31st, 1867. And some people say to me, well, how do you know that's the oldest ball? And, you know, I can say with 100% confidence that this is the first and oldest bladder-style football because it was patented. If there were any before it, they wouldn't have granted it a patent. So,
have you taken that ball to the Hall of Fame or the NFL or College Hall of Fame? I'm just curious that if they have anything close to anything like that.
Well, actually, the Hall of Fame, the oldest football in the Hall of Fame, is dated to be about 1890. So this ball is quite a bit older than that ball.
Wow!
Unbelievable. Yeah, when you sent that article over, I must have read it like four times, and I was just in shock to actually see that kind of find. And I received many, many comments on that article saying that it was just an incredible find on your part. And I said, well, knowing Bob's collection, I can see why he owns it, because you know, your collection is just unbelievable as far as what you own. But that really, really, to me, was just an amazing find. And again, because you have the patent, I do not question in any way, shape, or form that was a legal patent, and therefore that is the earliest football. Now, if somebody can prove an earlier patent, which I don't see many people forthcoming on that, you know what I mean? So that's amazing.
Well, you know, if there was an earlier patent of any kind, it would have to have been for a different type of ball.
Right, right, right.
Otherwise, there's no way.
I'm curious, Robert, what are the top three items in your collection?
Oh, boy.
Would that be one of them?
Yeah, that's it's hard to pick the top three, but if If I was on my way out of the house because it was on fire and I had to grab a couple items real quick, I'd say probably the 1860 football stocking cap I have, which also in the early catalogs you'll see them labeled as skull caps as well. You know, that was the earliest form of football headgear, and it took me, I'll bet I looked for something like that for, I don't know, decades. And, you know, I was really lucky to get one. So that, I'd say another one of my favorite items is an 1894 University of Pennsylvania football jacket or smock. And that's a real nice piece. It's got the player's initials painted on the front of the jacket. And on the back, very large, there's painted U of P and 94. And they're painted in Penn's colors of red and blue. And actually, I did some research on that, and I talked to the people at the University of Pennsylvania. And doing some research, I was able to actually identify the player. It was W. Stoddart, who graduated 1898 from their dental school. And the university sent me an old picture from their archives, a team picture. So that was really nice. I also have a full Spalding Union suit ensemble, which includes a sleeveless football jacket, along with the reeded pants and that great big elastic waistband that they would put around there to keep everything tight. And then I guess picking my top three, of course I would have to pick my 1867 football that we just talked about. And the reason I picked these as my top three is because they really date to the very beginning of American football. And the stocking cap is from the 1860s, the ball 1867, the football jacket 1894. I mean, we're talking about the stuff that forms the DNA of football.
That's an amazing top three. I mean, that is the history of the game, literally tied up in three pieces. It's just amazing. I'm curious when you mentioned that, for lack of a better term, the cape type uniform. Do you see? Let me rephrase that. Do you actually see those from time to time? Because I always have people ask me, you know, where can I find older uniforms? And they're talking about 30s and 40s, nothing that old. But do you actually see a lot of those, or are they exceptionally rare? I would assume they're rare, but since you are active in that section of the hobby, do you see them from time to time, often, whatever?
Well, the 30s and the 40s aren't that rare. You can pretty much find those on eBay. But getting back into the older stuff, I mean, the football jacket that I just talked about from the University of Pennsylvania, the 1894, it took me decades to get that. And I only have the one. And then the full Spalding football union suit, that's about a 1903 vintage uniform, and yeah, I only have one of those too. So there are a lot of items, and that's how, you know, when I start trying to answer a question like what's your favorite piece, that's what gets tricky, because you know there are pieces that I really really appreciate because of their history. But there's others that, because of their scarcity, I think, wow, it took me collecting 40 years. This is the only one I've ever seen of this that was available. For example, the football stocking cap.
Right.
And, you and know, I, and then I have some. I, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
So I was just saying, it's the scarcity of some of these items. And even with the helmets, I have a couple helmets that I've hunted for 10, 15, 20 years, and, you know, and they're just like one of a kinds, like the Chicago style helmet I have, and I have one of the one of the Spalding 50s, what they call it, the improved helmet, because they made it out of the real hard sole leather, and it only was around for a couple years because they outlawed that type of leather in the game.
You know, Robert, you know, I collect 49er uniforms, and I must say you've had much better success in finding things than I have. And the 49ers were started operation 1946. To find anything from 1946, 47, 48, it takes me years. Like I picked up, I think in the last 10 years, one jersey, an Alan Beals jersey from 1948, which he was one of the leading receivers in the Old American Football Conference. But to find an old shirt is really difficult, or a 49er shirt from that period. If I don't find it through a family or a relative, it just doesn't come up on eBay, or I just have to be lucky. You know, I got lucky one year just being in a 49er game, and somebody was walking around with a number 84 shirt. Well, it was a recent player, but he says his dad had an 84, number 84, which was Billy Wilson of the 49ers from 1956. So I made contact, and I ended up purchasing the jersey. But I have to extremely be lucky to find anything back when it gets back to the 40s or something like that. But you get them back to the early 1900s. That's incredible. That's incredible.
Yeah, very different focus, though, because I think I would have a real, real difficult time, too, if I sat down and said, I want Bobby Lane's jersey. I'd probably have to hunt and maybe never find that. So, you know, when I sit down and say, I want to see if I can find a uniform from the early 1900s, you know, I got a little bit broader of a range because I'm not specifically going after a certain player or a certain team.
Yeah.
I'm just going after a certain period.
That's very true. That's very true. Well, speaking of that, do you have any memorable collecting experiences you'd like to share with our audience?
I would have to say probably my most memorable collecting experiences kind of fall into two categories: odd finds and finding the odd. Yeah. And I guess what I mean by odd finds is, you know, sometimes you just get something that you didn't expect you would get, or didn't think you'd have an opportunity to get, and just the way it came to you is a little bit, and it's an odd find. I guess if I could give an example or two, I talked about the 1894 University of Pennsylvania football jacket I have. Mm-hmm. When I originally saw that, it was on an auction site, and it was listed as a cowboy vest. And it was actually displayed on a little mannequin over a flannel shirt.
Wow.
So, wow.
Amazing.
Holy mackerel.
And I have a 19.
Wow.
Yeah. It didn't take long, though, for people to tell the seller what they had. But I have a 1910 canvas flat top football helmet. And it actually, when I first saw it, it was with a pair of football pants and a pair of stacked wooden cleats. And this was back when I was still mostly getting my stuff from garage sales and yard sales and so forth. And this was, I had gone by an estate sale, and they were cleaning the house out. And there was a little pile of trash in the back that they were going to burn. And this uniform was in that pile of trash because they thought, that's nothing anybody would want. So I was able to save that from the pile of trash, and it's in my collection. And then those are what I consider odd finds. Finding the odd, I guess what I would call the odd items are some of the things I have in my collection that are part of the game of football, but not obvious items, not things that people would sit down and say, antique football. You know, most people think of the uniforms and the helmets and the balls and you know, but I've got some odd items that were part of the game that you just don't really think of. I have an example, I have a Goldsmith wire helmet form. It was made in the 1920s, And what it was for was when your helmet got wet, since the helmets were very soft and flexible then, you would stretch it over this form to keep its shape when you weren't wearing it.
Wow.
I have another example would be a Spalding lacing device that was used to lace the old footballs when you had to lace them and unlace them to inflate them. It's patented November 14th, 1925. And I have a variety, I have a lot of stuff like that. In fact, I was actually thinking of drafting an article for the magazine if you think your readers would be interested in some of these, what I call oddities of the sport.
Oh, I'm sure they would be. I mean, it's just incredible. Like I said, when I first got that, you know, when we met and you were talking about it, and I said, wow, I just couldn't believe that, because I really, over the years, yeah, I've met people, you know, who've collected specific team jerseys, team helmets. I never really met anybody over the years that went into the actual equipment of the game. And in your case, taking it, you know, from the beginning of the game to the 20s, the 30s, so on and so forth. So that's what makes, to me, your collection just so unique. And to me, it's Hall of Fame quality. I mean, it's stuff that I'm sure people in the Hall of Fame wouldn't even know what it is. You know what I mean? So it's truly amazing.
Can I ask Robert a question? Robert, this always floats through my mind that someday when I pass on, where will my collection go? And I'm thinking, well, my children don't care about collecting what I do, and then the Hall of Fame, I don't know, the 49ers. Do you have any thoughts like where your collection might end up someday, like in a museum?
You know, that's a question that I've asked myself many times and, you know, and pondered quite a bit. I have two sons, so I'm sure there's some stuff certainly that they would be interested in, but... And there are pieces that along the way that I've collected that, you know, for example, I had I can't pronounce the name of the college very well, but I had a football uniform that I researched through them, and when I researched it through their historic department, they were quite interested in getting it, and so there are some things that I've told my wife that when I pass on, you know, send this to that historic department or...
Mm-hmm.
But it is.
Yeah, it's floated through my mind too.
Yeah, but one thing that I really appreciated here, Martin, was about your book, because Bob, you were just talking about the focus of my collection, and that's what I went for. I'm going for the history of the sport. How did it start? How did it change? And what are all the things that went with it, not just the uniforms and the balls and stuff? I heard Martin talk about, you know, the vendor material and so forth. And I do have some vendor aprons and stuff like that. I mean, it was all part of the game.
Yeah, yeah. And again, what people don't realize, and I think, you know, Martin, you know, we've talked about this in the past too, they don't have a strong appreciation of the game. They don't have a strong appreciation of where the game came from. You know, when you really look at 1860s, you know, how rugby evolved into football, so on and so forth, they don't have an appreciation of where all this stuff came from, what it actually is, and is it actually preserved? And I use a simplistic example today. A lot of places, a lot of teams now are doing their media guide online, okay? Now, we mm-hmm. have... quite a few readers of Gridiron Greats who are, these are gentlemen who do not use the computer. You know, they still call me, they still write, and they want the physical piece of paper. And to me, paper is almost being phased out. For what reason, I really don't know, other than it's expensive to print, mail, so on and so forth. But we're losing a big part of our history of the game if, let's say, all of a sudden, the NFL decides, and I'm sure this is going to happen down the road, all media guides are online. You can't get a physical media guide anymore. And it's going to impact the history of the game. So what Martin has done with the 49ers and, Bob, what you've done with your equipment collection, it's mind-boggling, because you have preserved that whole aspect of the sport that to me would have been long, long gone if you two gentlemen did not, you know, work on it as diligently have, basically spending a lifetime collecting these items. And Bob, I'm just floored. I'm almost speechless. You know, when looking at your collection and seeing what you have there and just see, it is the history of the game that you've preserved and you've saved over the years. It's just, and it's an amazing accomplishment. And sadly, though, I think every collector comes to that point, okay, where's the collection go if something happens? And, you know, it's tough. I wish we could see more regional football-type museums in the country and not worry about having to go to a Canton to see the Pro Football Hall of Fame or go to the College Hall, Hall of Fame. If we could see regional, more regional types of museums, I think you could spread the history a lot better, number one, and number two, and educate more people on it.
Well,
you know,
Bob,
I mean,
you know the stadiums now, the NFL stadiums do incorporate museums inside. Like the 49ers
right.
have one, Green Bay, and a few other teams.
Yep.
So they
yep.
are doing that.
Yeah.
But I agree. I mean, that's the beauty of your magazine. It keeps the focus on history. I mean, there are a couple websites out there, too, that do. But for the most part, and I see it when I go to the National, you know, it's cards,
yep.
autographs, you know,
yep.
but what about the history? And you know, and I don't think until you hold some of this stuff in your hand, you can really appreciate it. I mean, I get an old football uniform or an old helmet. I put it on my head. I try it on. I want to know what it felt like to play with that stuff.
Yep.
I do the same thing, Robert. Except I do it before bed. Before bed, I'll pull out some programs or I'll pull out a uniform out of the closet, take a look at it, and put it back and go to bed with a good feeling, a good thought. That's what I do.
Well, as I tell everybody, one thing that I've done over the years, and Brenda finally understands it now, I pull out one of my old media guides, and I'll read it before I go to bed, because I normally read about an hour or two before I go to bed every night. And she said, you must have read that media guide at least 20 times over the past, you know, 6 or 7 years. I said, well, I enjoy reading it. And then, you know, I could pick up some obscure fact about a player or whatever that I missed, you know, the first 5 times I read it. And I have a bunch of media guides from the 50s, and I go through those all the time. I just love it. Or my old Street and Smiths. In fact, I was reading the other night a 1943 Street and Smith I picked up. And, I mean, it's classic World War II football. I mean, it's amazing. And you're reading history. That's what it's all about. And learning about the game. And I'm still learning about this game every day, especially with the magazine and especially talking with, guys like you. I mean, veteran historians of the game. That's what it really comes down to. So, Bob, we're going to head to our goal line stance. Any final comments or thoughts?
No, I'd just like to say thanks for having me on and giving me the opportunity to talk about my collection. I mean, I just love to talk about the history of the sport, and so I really appreciate having a chance to do that, and I appreciate folks like you and Martin who are out there keeping the history alive.
No, it was nice talking to you, Robert.
We appreciate your collection. And, again, I received so many comments initially for the Super Collector. And I've come upon some very, very interesting collections over the years. But I'll tell you, when I met you and you were telling me about it, I said, wow, I can't believe it. Literally, in all the years I've been doing this, you're the first person I ever knew who actually got into the physical aspect of the game, the footballs, the headgear, the uniform. I never dealt with anything like that. I was in awe of it. So I truly appreciate you coming on to the show, because you really gave us a great education on many pieces of your collection. And again, it was winter 2014 issue that you were featured as a Super Collector, and issue 54, which was 2 issues ago, about your oldest football. So if anybody's interested in those copies, we have ordering information on our website. And by the way, Bob, your extra issues went out on Friday, so you're all set with those.
Okay, great. No, and I did have a couple couple of things in your issue number 53 as well. Some interesting elements.
Oh, okay.
So folks may want to take a look at those as well.
Okay, good. All right. Thank you for being on the show, Bob. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
All right. We're down to only a few more minutes left of our show. It's time for our goal line stance. It'll be a new handoff here to Martin. Any thoughts or comments on what we learned on tonight's show?
It was truly amazing. It rekindled so many thoughts just going one after another through my mind. And the thing that kind of touched me, though, this is kind of off the subject, is that he spoke of his wife and you spoke of your wife. And I've had two divorces, one wife saying I love Hugh McElhaney more than her, and the other one saying I love Joe Montana more than her. And what really strikes me is that what a fanatic I really am. And I've come to the conclusion that my collection and collecting is more important than anything probably besides my children. And listening to Robert talk about his collection, I know how much passion he has for his, and I'm thinking how much passion I have for mine, and I start to think, well, gee, I'm not the only one. I'm not alone. There's other people who also have passions for their collections. They're just not in it to make a few bucks, you know.
Martin, I can assure you there's many, many passionate collectors out there who are not concerned about value. I'll make a real quick story here. There's a friend of mine who I've traded football cards with probably for almost 30 years now. And he always tells me, you know, Bob, I'm going to have a big problem when I go because I don't know what would anybody do with my collection? And here's a guy, he's, you know, collecting pre-World War I football postcards and stuff all the way up to the new year. You know, he's got an amazing collection, but he says to me all the time, I've had a great run, a great fun doing this. So how do you put a price on that? And it's true. It's true.
Yeah.
I mean, just learning about all this stuff, the fun of the hunt to collect. I still get excited going to tag sales. Brenda and I, you know, hit a lot of tag sales during tag sale season here. I still go to a lot of local shows. I never know what I'm going to find. Going to the Nationals become more of a social event for me than finding anything because it's nice seeing a lot of collectors, readers of GG, you know, people like yourself. People
you're
like
in
Bob.
A great part of the
yeah.
country though, because out here in the West, Bob, it's not like when I go back east and I go to Chicago, New York, it seems like I'll go
yep.
buy a newsstand and there'll be like 100 people looking at Chicago Cub magazines or whatever. And I'm
yep.
thinking, geez, it's not like that out here. You know, and it seems
yep.
like nobody cares. But I think back east, you're passionate fans. Maybe that's because that's where it all started. Football started
yep.
back there. And
yeah,
I think,
and again, myself growing up in the 60s, I treasured every magazine I got, and I kept it. I was a pack rat. I collected everything, so I established my own collection at a very young age. But I think you're right, because there's a lot of passion, and I see it more in Chicago. I saw it a little this year in Atlantic City, where I saw a bunch of people I hadn't seen in a long, long time at a regional show. And I saw people I never saw before coming to a national, and they were, you know, poking around trying to figure out what was going on there type of thing. And, again, to me, Atlantic City was smaller than the last Chicago National or even the Cleveland National. But you still had a lot of interesting things there, a lot of interesting stuff. And it was somewhat of a good education for some people looking at this stuff at the same time. But you're right. I think
Chicago especially, yeah.
That's why I think the people who run the National are very comfortable with the Atlantic City, Baltimore, Cleveland, and Chicago route. Because I know after Chicago this year, 2017, they'll be in Cleveland in 2018. And I know that's going to draw that strong football Midwest
oh, yeah.
crowd there.
Yeah, because like I said, yeah. But it was sure interesting listening to Robert talk about his collection. It made me think about, you know, how I got Leo Nomolini's water bottle or Bobby Lane's flask
yeah,
that he took a
yeah.
couple of shots of whiskey from. These were all things I picked up on the sidelines. But I guess I could consider
yeah.
myself lucky that I grew up working at the games than just starting to collect from the outside, maybe at a later age, because I grew up with collecting. So
right.
it makes it a little bit
right.
more meaningful. And
it is. It is. Well, Marion, we're out of time. Thank you so much for filling in tonight. It was great talking football with you and our guest, Bob Tibby. I have to say goodnight and goodnight from Gridiron
okay,
Brinks,
Bob.
Where the legends of the gridiron will always live on. Thank you so much,
Thank
Brian,
you,
for being on the show.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Everybody have a great night. Thanks for listening. And again, check out MSB Sports Cards and their website, www.msbsportscards.com, and BST Auctions, bstauctions.com. Thank you for listening. You can also check out our website, Gridiron Greats Magazine, at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.